Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Like I said, those who are just, you know, coming in, if you have a Chumash handy, it's probably not a bad idea. Okay, Shana Tov, everybody. Gemar Chatima Tov. I hope everybody had a meaningful Yontif. I think not quite back to normal, but a lot more normal than last year was. And please God, next year we'll be back to, you know, fully normal. Not that everything in normal is so good, but I think you know what I mean. Okay, Parshat Vayelech. So here we are on Friday morning with the Parshas here. So, of course, it's the shortest Parsha of the year. I always say, you know, like Rosh Hashanah, between just before Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot, we read the shortest Parsha of the year. Nitzavim Vayelech often is a double Parsha. Depends if there's an extra Shabbos between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, which there is this year. And since there is, the parshiot are split, but one is 40 psukim, one is 30 psukim, Hazinu is 52 psukim. I figure there's so much shul, you know, the rabbis were nice to us and they made the Torah learning, you know, laney, you know, shorter. Now, of course, the fact that we end the year with these parshiot is not exactly coincidental, but as we all know, for much of our history, the Torah was run on a triannual cycle. So they didn't finish with Vezora Bracha every year. There was no Simchas Torah, et cetera, et cetera. And all the things in the in rabbinic literature that you should read this before that week and this then, those were additional readings. In other words, when the Gemara says that Ezra, who was really responsible for our cycle of Torah reading, so we're going back 2,600 years, the beginning of the Second Temple period, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, so who were established our religious ways of life, the patterns of religiosity was established by Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. So Ezra, besides our Tfilot and our Brachot and Kiddush Havdalah, so Ezra was the main person responsible for the way we read Torah Monday, Thursday, and the Aliyot, etc. So he made a decree that we should read Parshat Ki Tavo before Rosh Hashanah. But that doesn't mean the way we read Parshat Ki Tavo, that the cycle of the calendar works out. Oh, every year Ki Tavo is before Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, okay, now we do that. But what it meant when you had a triannual cycle, so Ki Tavo wasn't before Rosh Hashanah, but it meant that every year before Rosh Hashanah, nonetheless, you read the Brachot and Klalot. And I assume they did not read the entire Parsha. I'm assuming they didn't read Bikurim. They didn't read Parshat Ki Tavo as we know Parshat Ki Tavo. They read the curses, the blessings and the curse. As the Gemara says, Tichle Shana v'kilulotah, the year should come to end and this curse should come to an end. And Tosfa points out, we don't even read it the week before Rosh Hashanah. We don't want to read curses right before Rosh Hashanah. So we always read Ki Tavo. The way the way we today establish the annual cycle is Parshat Ki Tavo is always read 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. There's always Nitzavim or Nitzavim and Vayelech, depending if it's a double Parsha, is always the week before Rosh Hashanah. Okay, that's just the way the Torah reading works. Or when wild example is on the Dalet Parshiot, the four special Parshiot of the week we read between Purim and Pesach. So that's what they read. It wasn't like they had Parshiot HaShavua and they did the Maftir. That was what they read. In other words, we do it today slightly differently because we have an annual cycle. So we're adding on. We're grafting, so to speak, like Parshat Zachor as a maftir. But when they read Parshat Zachor as Parshat Zachor, they read it as a laning. Danny Sperber has an article. How do they have like seven aliyot from Parshat Zachor? For Parshat Achodesh and Parshat Shkalim, they're longer. Parshat Zachor is three or four psukim. So whatever, that's not our topic now. Okay, Vayelech is the shortest Parsha in the Torah, though, at only 30 psukim. But it's got two of the last two mitzvot of the of the Torah, the 613, the way our count is, we've mentioned many times, there is no accepted count of the 613 mitzvot. No, can't go anywhere to find a list. I mean, you can go places to find a list, but no two lists will agree. Not the Sefer Achinuch has his list. He's following the Rambam. The Ramban has a list, 31 mitzvot different from the Rambam. So they agree, whatever, 580 something mitzvot. But, the Bahag has his list. Bal Halachot Gdolot, the first one in the 8th century to write a list. His list is different from both of those lists. And the Smag, the Sefer Mitzvot, everybody has their own list. Because the Torah wasn't a big deal, 613 mitzvot. But as far as I know, everybody agrees with these last two mitzvot. And that's the mitzvot, of course, of Hakel, of gathering together once in 7 years at the end of the Shemitah year. So that means like a year from now, because we just started Shemitah. As I'm sure everybody knows, this is a Shemitah year. I had I don't know what you want to call it, the schut, the merit, or the inconvenience of being in Israel twice, learning in yeshiva for a year during the year of Shemitah. But that's for a different shir, how exactly to observe Shemitah nowadays. But the Hakel is connected, as we're going to discuss, to the end of the Shemitah, the eighth year, next year on Sukkot, and then where it's followed by the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah. Now, that mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah is not actually directly, it's not the simple reading of the text of the Chumash. Moshe Rabbeinu, or God tells Moshe to command the Jewish people this: if you have a Chumash open, this is Perek Lamed Aleph. It's one Perek, the whole Parsha, chapter 31, beginning of verse 14. But this is in verse 19, Batakitu lachem at the shirazot. And now you should write this song and teach it, Valamda ben Israel, and teach it, Sima b'fi, and put them in their mouth. What's this song? So the simple meaning is Hazinu. 15 verses later, you have Parshat Hazinu, which we'll read next week, Hazinu Shemaim, and it's written as a song. It's written as a poem. There are two songs like that written Torah, Az Yashir. So Kidu lachem at the shira hazot refers to Hazinu. What's Hazinu? It also ties in to the year and cycle. Hazinu is really a continuation in many ways of Kitavo. Hazinu is we call upon the heavens and the earth to testify. If we don't remember, Zechor Yamot Olam, remember our history, remember God taking us out, Vayishman Yishruun Vayivat, don't get too fat and throw out the mitzvot. Hazinu is really a warning in poetic form. So that's really what Moshe is saying. Kitu lachem et hashira hazot. Nonetheless, the rabbis had an interpretation that shira hazot refers to the entire Torah. We discussed last year, maybe at the end, if I have time, I'll briefly mention it because it's such a beautiful commentary of the Netziv. Natali Tzvi Huda Berlin has an explanation why the Torah is called a shira, which he defines as a poem. But he says the Torah, when the rabbis say Hashira Hazot, it doesn't just mean Shirat Hazino. The entire Torah is a shira, is a song or a poem. I mean, they're not exactly the same thing, but they are a related song song and a poem, the Torah. And therefore, that's the mitzvah today that every Jew is supposed to write a Sefer Torah. I mentioned, maybe, I don't know if I mentioned here so often, but according to the Shulchan Aruch already, this mitzvah doesn't apply to nowadays. I'm a big believer in not doing this mitzvah, if I can say that. I'll explain what I mean in half a second. In other words, it says in the Torah, write this book and teach it to the Jewish people. Write this song. So since the Torah puts the purpose of the mitzvah right there in the mitzvah, Kitu lachem et hashira hazot, write this song and teach it to the Jewish people. So it means the purpose of this mitzvah is so we can teach Torah. So the Rosh writes, Rabbeinu Asher in the 13th century, and this view is accepted by the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch, that that only applied in an era where we weren't allowed to write down the oral law. The only book you were allowed to write down was the Torah itself. So we had to write the Torah so we can learn from it. But today you have Art Scroll, you have Koran, you have Sansino, you have 8 million different books. So the mitzvah was transformed into having a Jewish library. It doesn't necessarily mean, and that's a good reason why most people, I have not fulfilled this mitzvah in its classical sense of commissioning a Sefer Torah. For many people, it's because it's very expensive. Okay, if you can't afford it, you're not allowed to do the mitzvah. It's going to cost you $50,000. So unless you're wealthy, you can't, you're not allowed to spend more than 20% of your savings on any mitzvah. So unless you have $250,000 in the bank, then you're not allowed to do the mitzvah. Okay, a lot of people do have $250,000, the stock market. So the other reason they don't observe this mitzvah is because the mitzvah is being transformed into a book, into a mitzvah of having a Jewish library. When I say I'm opposed to this mitzvah, that doesn't sound right. But what I mean is there are way too many Sefer Torah in the world around. You look around, go into your shul, how many Sefer Torah? Most of them you see only on Simchas Torah. They use the same one or two every week, and the other 10, depending on how big your shul is. But even in small shuls, so the other four sit in the Chumash, and once every 3 years when we have to do 3 Sefer Torah on Shabbos, they take that out, and So they're very expensive. So I recommend the Lamda B'nai Yisrael, the mitzvahs teach the Jewish people, instead of commissioning a Sefer Torah, give the money to Jewish education. Give it to your local day school and give it to lower tuition so more people can come to school. That's my personal pet peeve, if you want to call it that. I really think that's the fulfillment of the mitzvah. That's what it says in the Torah. Write this song so you can teach it to the Jewish people. It's more important to teach through day school education than to teach through having an extra Sefer Torah in the Aron Kodesh. Okay, you don't have to agree with me, but anyways. Okay, so I want to discuss these two mitzvahs, and then we're going to tie it into Shemitah, because what's a little bit strange, and this is in chapter 31, verse 10, by Moshe, Lemor. Moshe commands the Jewish people, Miketz Sheva Shani, Miketz, at the end of 7 years, Bimoed, Shnat HaShemitah, at the, on the holiday, some, a Moed. Interesting that the Torah calls Shemitah a Moed. Moed is a Moedei Kodesh, Mikrei Kodesh. Those are all the holidays. So it's interesting that Shemitah gets that name. It's called the Moed Shnat HaShemitah. In the end, B'chak HaSukkot. So this mitzvah is in Shemitah on Chag HaSukkot. Now, it's not really Shemitah because it's the eighth year. Shemitah ends on Rosh Hashanah next year. So it's, even the whole description is funny. B'vokol Yisrael le'rod apnei Hashem Elokecha. When all the Jewish people are going to come, because there's a mitzvah on the Shalosh Regalim, the three pilgrim festivals come to Jerusalem. So, b'makom ha'shevchar that God chooses, tikra the Torah zot. You should read this Torah. Now, what is this Torah? Those who have been coming to Rabbi Liebtag's, you know, shiurim, know that the word Torah in the Torah doesn't mean what we call Torah. The word Torah means like a section of Torah. Zot Torah ha'olah. These are the laws of the Ola sacrifice. So, and that's why there's the, everybody agrees the king doesn't read the entire Torah. You'd be there for, till the end of Shemini Atzeret, till Cheshvan if he did that. He reads highlights from Sefer Dvarim. He reads up to Shema. He reads 10 chapters. Because, so Tikrat HaTorah HaZot, this Torah, Neged Kol Yisrael, Bo's name, he reads it the entire Jewish people. Hakel Atam, gather the people. Anashim Nashim Bataf. We know this is a famous mitzvah. It's men, women, children, not only children. Like, okay, your six-year-old kid, if he knows how to shake the lulav, it's nice. You don't have to buy him his own lulav, but it's also maybe a waste of money. I don't know. But but we want to train them in the use of the lulav. But your kid in diapers, you don't train him with the lulav. He's going to break the pitum on the etrog. You know, that's what the kid's going to do. So you don't give him the etrog, right? It's no mitzvah to try to train a kid who doesn't understand. But that's not true by Hakel. This is sort of, as far as I know, the only mitzvah in the Torah that applies. Okay, a brit milah, but the brit milah really applies to the father. The only mitzvah that tough, that little infants come to. And the question is, why? Why do the infants come? Anybody want to tell me why this Torah command? Like your kid in diapers, your kid who's, you're 3 weeks old, you come to Hakel, if you know why. So, right. So the classic answer of the Gemara is Levi Sachar Mivayim. It's not so much for them, it's to give reward to those who bring them. So that's an interesting idea that, what does that mean? Why? But it distracts you. You know, you got your kid in diapers. It's hard to listen to the king when, you know,
to enable the mothers to be there.
So that's just, yeah, but you're obligated to bring, in other words, it's a way to get the mothers to come. Cause if you have to bring the four month old infant, the mother has to come. That's interesting. You can't, in other words, you're not allowed to get, and the mother's not going to get a babysitter. So it's better. That's an interesting idea. I haven't heard that before, but that's quite interesting. There also could be the idea of, it's somehow, you know, the Beethoven effect, what's it called? The Mozart effect, you know, you get pregnant and you play Mozart. So I don't know that it works at all, but anyways, but that's what the Mishnah, I'm sorry?
Because the babies were also at Har Sinai and it's a reenactment.
Ah, excellent. Babies were at Har Sinai, it's a reenactment. Okay, that's very interesting. Very well, we'll come to that. Excellent. Also could be like, I have to tie it into Pirkei Avot. That Rabbi Yeshua's mother, Ashrei Yoledeto, the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai praised, I think it was Rabbi Yeshua, his mother brought him as an infant to shul. There's sort of an idea that'll have an impact on the kid, perhaps. But I think all this is true. I think the reenactment of Har Sinai, make the mother come and bring reward for the people. But I think it, for the people who bring them. But I also think it doesn't matter that it's harder to hear when the three-month-old baby is running around or the three-month-old baby is sleeping, that the two-year-old kid, you got to keep your eye on. So how can you listen to the king? But that's we don't really care. What do I mean? As we'll discuss, the whole purpose of Hakel is the experience of everybody coming together. The fact that you didn't hear the speech, it's the experience, they made
a big...
I think
it's the impact of the whole crowd, everybody there.
I'll be as a proud Canadian, if I may. So I watched the last 10 minutes of the women's semifinals of the U.S. Open. As many of you know, there's a Canadian in it who just turned 19 2 days ago, and she, beat three people in the top five. You know, this is like an amazing run. And 2 years ago, we had a Canadian, Bianca Andreescu, won the U.S. Open 2 years ago, the first time a Canadian had ever won a major event, woman or men, in history. And now we have this young 18-19-year-old who's going to the finals on Saturday. So they asked her at the end, how did she do it? She said, how the New York crowd, the articles here, the New York crowd has fallen in love with her. They're rooting for her over her poem, and she has sort of a charisma about her. So it's the crowd inspires. And Lahavdil, that's exactly what's going on here. Who cares? Are you paying attention? You go to a World Series game, you don't know what baseball is, but the excitement of the crowd base or the Super Bowl, people go to the Super Bowl, they don't care, but there's a certain power of the crowd. And that's exactly what the Torah is saying by Hakel. So you want to bring the kids, doesn't matter that the parents will be distracted. Yes, there is. The Torah does say purpose is to learn. That's true too. But there's this idea of the experience of everybody coming together, which is so important. But this is the only mitzvah you have to bring kids. Okay, so that's the mitzvah of Hakel. We'll have to discuss what does it have to do with Shemitah? Why Dafka in the Shemitah year? And why Dafka on Sukkot? And why does the Torah link it? But more way, and it's not really the Shemitah year, but the Torah calls it the Shemitah year, like the end of the Shemitah year, the eighth year. Okay, we'll come back to that, hopefully. And then, of course, right after that is the mitzvah to write the Sefer Torah. So just to compare a couple, these two mitzvot, in many ways, they're sort of opposites, or they complement, but they have differences. So first of all, it's Hakel is what we would call, Torah Shebal Peh. It's oral. It's an oral reading. It's the reciting of the Torah that is the mitzvah. And of course, the writing the Sefer Torah, that's like the Torah Shebichtav. In other words, first the Torah describes an oral recitation of the Torah, parts of the Torah, and then the Torah gives a mitzvah to write down Sefer Torah. And we know writing and oral are very different ways of learning. And we know Torah Shebal Peh, we've discussed the I love, the Dor Ravi's explanation, the grandson of the Chatam Sofer, that's why it's called Dor Ravi, the fourth generation Glasner, Shmuel Moshe Glasner, died in 1924. So he writes that the Torah is meant to be oral. The main, we all know Torah Shebal Peh is meant to oral because oral is flexible and we want the Torah to be flexible. Once something gets written down and it's right here, precedent, we can't change. And that's exactly what we don't want. We want a Shofet Asher Yeh Bayamimim to be in that time. In Torah, we're so not used to this because we've had 2,000 years of not doing this but the idea, he said it was a great tragedy, the writing down of the Torah. We had no choice, but it wasn't meant to be written down. And that was bad. And when we come back to Israel, we're going to go back to the original system and oral and et cetera. Written and oral are two totally different forms of learning Torah. But these are what these two mitzvot are. Hakel, of course, as we're describing, is a national event. It's the event of the nation coming together. Writing a Torah is very individualistic. Every individual has a mitzvah to write a Torah. By the way, I'm not going to get into the halachic discussion about does this mitzvah apply to women? Women have to say Birchat Torah, they have to learn Torah. They have their exempt from one little aspect, but it's generally assumed that women are included, I believe, at least partially in this mitzvah and should participate in the mitzvah. But and for sure, by Hakel, they are involved. That's very clear in the Torah. But this is a very individualistic thing. But the purpose is the same. In other words, Hakel Ata'am, why? Leman Yishme'u, Leman Yilmedu. To hear, and Yishma'u is not even so much to hear, it's to pay attention. Hazino Hashemember, the word Shema is like, hold up, hold your horses, pay attention. And that's like, I think that's the being inspired by the whole crowd, Leman Yishma'u. And secondly is Leman Yilmedu. Then you should learn. It's not first you should, learn, and then to fear God. It's not that you're learning, you're not going to learn how to keep halacha from Hakel. It's the experience of being in the temple with hundreds of thousands of other people that will lead to the fear of God. That's what the by Maser Sheni, the second tithe. So the Mishnah says you have to be 10% in Jerusalem. Why? Because that's a way to fear of God. The being in the presence of Jerusalem is religiously inspiring. It still is today. Not always, not all the time, but we know that. That's what it's meant to be. It's a place that God has chosen, a place for religious inspiration. And of course, the writing down of the Sefer Torah is lumped up in the Israel. You have to teach it to the Jewish people. Now, what's very interesting is the Torah here, the mitzvah is on the king to read the Sefer Torah. This is a mitzvah only on the king. Has anybody been to Hakel in modern day Israel? I have not been. I've never been in Israel. I've been to Israel, I said, twice in the Shemitah year, but never in the eighth year. I was never in the year after Shemitah. So today at the Kotel, I understand I don't know if it goes back to 48 already. I seem to see an article in Tradition written in 1959 about the Hakel ceremony. So I imagine it goes back to the beginning of the State of Israel. We haven't had so many Shemitahs. Israel is 73 years old, 10 Shemitahs. So they do a reenactment of Hakel. I think it's a beautiful thing, just like the Israeli Knesset is 120 people, because the Anshei Knesset Agol was the 120. Even these secular Zionists, you know, have a connection to our tradition, which is really a beautiful thing. So they set up, they do Hakel, and the president of the State of Israel, he's the king. That's what Rav Kook writes. Rav Kook writes that when you have a democracy, so the elected, the president's not elected, but meant who you choose as your leaders, that has the status of a melech. A melech doesn't mean a monarch, like the old monarchs, that they do whatever they want. It means the leader of the people. And we know that it's not so clear the Torah wants a monarchy. We know there's a major debate that many commentaries thought a king is a terrible idea, and our experience with kings were not very good. And many people say the Torah allowed a king. It didn't obligate a king. The Rambam, he differs. But even so, it doesn't necessarily mean that a king is to be the monarch, like the way we think of a monarchy. The king can be the leader of a democracy. So that's how Rav Kook explains it. When you have the leader, the people have a democracy. So the democratic leaders get the status of king. So presumably it's the president more than the prime minister. I don't know what Rav Kook would say about that, because the president doesn't really have so much power legislatively, but whatever. The president, as we know, is the functional head of the state, just like the governor general is in Canada, sort of higher than the prime minister, even though they don't really have power, but they do have power because they can tell which prime minister gets the right to form a government. So anyway, that they have the president of the State of Israel read the Hakel at the Kotel. I think it's a beautiful thing. They do this on Sukkot and the Shemitah year. But the Torah has so it's for the king. The Torah in Parshat Shoftim has another mitzvah, and that mitzvah is for the king to write a Sefer Torah. And it's because, why does the king have to write a Sefer Torah? And as a matter of fact, according to Rashi, see, it says in that this is in Parshat Shoftim. So it's chapter 17 in Dvarim. If you have a Chumash, chapter 17, Parshat Dvarim, the Torah talks about appointing a king beginning at verse 14. You want to have a king? Okay, you can have a king. It doesn't sound like the Torah. You want a king? Okay, you can have a king. So can't have a lot of horses, can't have a lot of wives, can't have too much money, all the things that will give the king too much arrogance, and which we know is always power corrupts, and we don't want the king to have too much power.
But
so,
then he'll remember that Hashem is above him.
Right, but because of what Mishnah HaTorah Hazot, so it's a very funny expression. He should write the Mishnah Torah. So we know Mishnah Torah is Sefer Dvarim. Now the king only reads from Sefer Dvarim at Hakel. Rashi, following Chazal, say what is Mishnah? Mishnah from the word to repeat. So the king has to have two Sefer Torah. One he writes in is like and has in the library, and when he walks, he carries with him the whole time, whenever the king walks. I know it's an unbelievable thing. Can you imagine walking around all day with the Torah, even if it's not the whole Torah, even if I interpret, it's only little bits. That is such a burden. Who would want to be the king? Like, you know, yeah, it's nice to get a hakafa on Simchas Torah, you know, and the woman like hakafas, but if you have to have hakafas 10 hours a day, every day of your life, you wouldn't want that. I don't care how like the Sefer Torah. I don't know, maybe you would, but I find that that's a real burden on the king, which I think is the purpose of the mitzvah. So that's the second Torah he has to carry. But the Torah, Vaita'imo, it should be with the Mekarabo, Kol Yemechayav. His entire life, he should be reading it all the time. Leman yilmad b'yirat Hashem Elohav, in order to learn to fear God. That's exactly the expression used in Hakel. It's like the king is taking the Sefer Torah that he was commanded to write, and he thinks that's Sefer Torah, which is for him to fear God. He says, I don't know. I'm not the only one who has to fear God. I'm going to read it for you, for every single person in the nation. You too have to fear God. The language is quite striking. Lishmor kol divrei ha-Torah zot, that they should keep kol divrei ha-Torah zot, which is exactly the expression used in Vayelech. Lishmor la-Seda kol divrei ha-Torah zot. It's a very funny expression. And yet the Torah uses it by the writing of the king, and the Torah uses it here by the mitzvah of Hakel. So it's clear this king has taken sort of his Sefer Torah, and he's reading it for everybody. Now, what's fascinating about these two mitzvot is the context. The mitzvah of Hakel is given in a very happy occasion. The beginning of the parsha, verse 7, Vayikra Moshe Yoshua. Remember, Moshe's, that's Vayelech. Vayelech is the last day of Moshe's life. He's about to die. He's 120. That's what he says. Ben Me'a Shana Veshima Nocheyom, Lo Uchalot, let's say, Filavoet. That's it. I'm out of here. Hashem Amar Eli, Lo Tavor Ni Yordana Zeh. God has said, you're going to die. You're not going to cross the Jordan. God will keep you okay. Now Yoshua, so he's giving the people a pep talk. And he said, you're going to come in. Don't worry. Don't worry. I'm gone. Who cares? You don't need me. You got Yoshua. Yoshua, he's better than me. He's a military general. He defeated Amalek, right? Chazek v'amatz, be strong. You're going to come. He's telling Yoshua also, Vashem hu alech lefanav, God will be with you, don't worry. Vayichtov Moshe, and Moshe writes the Sefer Torah, gives it to all the tribes. And then he tells him, by the way, it's like sort of a weird connection. Every 7 years, you got to come together and read the Torah on Sukkot when everybody's here. But it's a very, very uplifting message. The message is that this is our tie to the land. Of course, you're going to conquer the land. Don't worry. Everything's going to be great. God is going to be with you. And just every 7 years, have a pep talk to remind yourself that Torah is the foundation of our life. That's Hakel. The mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah is a totally different context. It's like the total opposite. Follows immediately. Vayomer Shem Moshe, Hein Karvu Yamech Alamud, you're about to die. Call Yoshua again. So last time he called Yoshua to tell Yoshua, be strong. You're going to take in. Everything's going to be great. I'm going to be with you. No worries. And now God has a different message. It's like five verses later. In verse 16, Tetzayin. You're going to now lie with your ancestors. Interesting expression. You're gone, Moshe. You kept them in line. You were the great disciplinarian. People are going to worship idols. They're going to follow the ways of the nation. They're going to leave me. They're going to nullify my covenant. I'm going to be really angry at these people. And I'm going to leave them. I'm going to hide my face. This is the famous notion, Hester Panim, to hide the face. This is where it comes from. And this, so God is telling Moshe, you're going to die. The Jewish people are going to do terrible sins. I'm going to get really mad. I'm going to leave them. And they're going to be finished, man. You know, living in the Middle East without the protection of God, it's, as our politicians tell us all the time, it's the hard, you know, it's the toughest neighborhood in the world. We need God to help us. So rabot, rabot, it's going to be terrible. Ra'ot, rabot, many evil things, but sarot, many problems. And the people say, there's no God. God has forsaken us. Yeah, he doesn't care about us. All true. Vanochi Esther Panai. I'm going to hide my face. Al Kora. Vata. And now, in order that this doesn't happen, write down this song. And teach it to the Jewish people. This is my witness. It's going to be testimony. Jewish people are going to say, why does God abandon us? Here's the testimony. I made a covenant here. It's written down. Everybody has it in their library. And yet they don't follow it. That's why. So it's the context of the mitzvah is totally different. It's like, I don't fully know how to explain it, but the mitzvah of Hakel is very upbeat, positive, wonderful. Of course, the Jewish people coming together to the Beit HaMikdash, but it's also, don't worry, God is going to be with you, protect the whole time. And then immediately the Torah says, God is going to leave you alone. I'm not going to leave you. He'll forsake you because you're going to sin. And therefore you better, you better learn the Sefer Torah. Otherwise, you're going to be in really big trouble. So it's like, it's just a very different and fascinating context. The different Doshim Mitzvah, and of course, both are true. Both, you know, the times are great. Sometimes God is great and is with us and protecting us, and sometimes awful things happen. I mean, the Holocaust and the State of Israel, back to back, just in reverse order. That's exactly what we had in the, not so, so long ago, that we had Hester Panim, the greatest Hester Panim in history with the Holocaust. And then we had the greatest, recovery and the greatest demonstration of God's concern for the Jewish people, that after 2,000 years, a nation comes back to its homeland. So we see this, whatever exactly, unfortunately, happening in our time. And of course, if Hester Panim, Yom Kippur, of course, is the opposite of Hester Panim, right? What Yom Kippur is all about, Lifnei Hashem Titaru, coming before God. It's the closest to God. Sin is Mavdil, right? Sin separates us from God, and Tshuva is the return to God. So that's, I mean, this all ties in. There we read last week, mitzvah zot, this mitzvah is not too far. The Ramban says we're talking the mitzvah of tshuva, the mitzvah of tshuva. And the Torah is continuing on this theme. In other words, writing the Sefer Torah seems to be an act of tshuva, that everybody has to have their own Sefer Torah. It's an act of tshuva. And what does that act of tshuva mean? It means you come close to God, because otherwise God is mastir panav, God hides his face. And then we have to come back. So that's just sort of the outline, these two mitzvot, which in many ways are connected. There's the mitzvah of orally coming together as a nation to study Torah, to be the experience, the man yishma'u, to hear lira. It's the fear of God. It's the whole experiential aspect. And then there's every individual has to have in their library, in their home, walk around with their own Sefer Torah today, with their own Jewish books that they study on their own. And that's a way to connect them. The fact that the Jewish people can come together, obviously that's a sign of the special nation or the special relationship with God. When alone, it's a whole different type of a relationship. But that's, these are these two mitzvot that form the end of Torah, coming together as a people to celebrate the Torah, so to speak, Simchas Torah. I mean, it's connected, right? In a certain sense, Hakel is like a yearly Simchas Torah, or every 7 years. That's what we today do. It's a very similar idea. We finish the Torah, we read the Torah, we give Chatan Torah, we give like the king, the rabbi, usually they give to the greatest, you know, scholar to finish the Torah. That's the minhag in a lot of places. That's the mitzvah of Hakel. Everybody comes to shul. We call up the little kids for aliyot and everything. So that's really Simchas Torah, is in many ways a reenactment of Hakel. And then we have the obligation to write your own Sefer Torah. But what I want to develop now a little bit, spend the rest of the time, is what exactly is the connection between Shemitah and Sukkot. The Torah points out, b'moed shnat ha-shemitah, at the end of the Shemitah year, b'chag ha-sukkot. You can have the mitzvah of Hakel not on Sukkot, you have it not connected to Shemitah. Why did the Torah make that's how the Torah defines the mitzvah. Miketz sheva shanim b'moed shnat ha-shemitah b'chag ha-sukkot. So the simplest answer, right? You always have to look. What's the simple, plain answer of the Torah? And then what's our deeper answers? They complement each other. So the simplest answer is, this is the time you're most likely to get most people coming to Israel. You know, there's a mitzvah, or to the Beit HaMikdash, the Yerushalayim. There is a mitzvah to go on Aliyah LeRegel three times a year. How many Jews do you think went every Yontif to the Beit HaMikdash? So you have to ask the historians if they know. But I can guarantee you it was not everybody. People did not all go three times a year. And there is a lot of evidence for that, but that's not, doesn't really matter. What matters is, when are they most likely to go? They're most likely to go at the end of a Shemitah year, because there's nothing to do. They were farming. They weren't farming all year. In other words, Sukkot time after Shemitah is probably the time where you're going to get the biggest attendance at in the temple. So that could be just a very, very simple explanation. It's b'moed shnat ha-shemitah b'vo kol Yisrael, when all the people come. It's sort of hinted at Torah. This is the time at the end of the Shemitah year and Sukkot. That's the most time when people are going to be there. So the mitzvah of Hakel, the Torah wanted every 7 years. And of course, seven is the magic number, right? Seven is always a cycle. We need rejuvenation after seven. Every seventh day, we need a Shabbat. Every seventh year, we need a Shemitah. Every seven cycles, we need a Yovel. And the seventh month, right? We need seven means, right? We need 7 days to celebrate the wedding and Chas V'Shalom, a Shiva. Seven allows for a complete cycle. And then we, you know, on for good occasion, we need that cycle again. So it when in that 7 years was less important. So the Torah seems to say, well, when are most people going to come? Chag HaShemitah, the end of the Shemitah and Chag HaSukkot. But obviously that's not it's a nice little thing, but I would not want that as my whole answer.
Maybe the other way. It seems to me once you're in Shemitah, chalos, what you managed to do before Shoshana, you managed. What you can now you can't go into the field. Now the Shemitah is over, you can't wait until you can get back and start working.
You want to say it's the opposite. You want to say it's the opposite. They're not going to come that soon. So I think that could be. In other words, it's the exact opposite of what I said. But I think what it is that they're probably not going to start so early. In other words, I don't think the farming cycle, they're going to start soon after the sukkah. In other words, this is the end of vacation, like the end of summer. Everybody goes away on Labor Day weekend. They used to, because, you know, it's the end of the summer. I want to get my last break of vacation. So before we go back, we've had the whole year off. I mean, what are you doing in Shemitah? We've had the whole year off. So before we go back to the farm, you know what? I've enjoyed this. Let's go visit Jerusalem. We're going to come together, have a nice time, eat some meat, drink some wine, have a nice time. But I hear your point, but Jinzi, they could both be true, even though they say the opposite. But that's, you know, true about a lot of things here. But thank you. Okay, so I just want to briefly discuss Shemitah, things that perhaps are obvious. And then I think it'll sort of be obvious what's the connection to Sukkot. So how many times does Shemitah, now maybe I'm wrong, but that's why I'm asking you, how many times does Shemitah appear in the Torah? If I ask you, where's Shemitah written in the Torah? So you're going to tell me? Don't be afraid. I won't mark you wrong.
Bahar.
So that's the main place, right? Bahar, that's where the Torah says you can't prune and you can't harvest and you can't peel. That's the main cycle. And then we get into Yovel. Excellent. Ma'inyan Shemitah leitzel har Sinai, right? Sheshanim tisas adecha v'shana shviit, right? Okay, very good. Where else is it written? It's written before.
Is it Re'eh?
It's written in Re'eh. What's the theme of Re'eh?
Money.
Totally different. Not one word about not working the field. We'll get there. It's about that your loans are, debts are canceled. You wouldn't know it had anything to do with the land. And interestingly enough, somebody came to me in Shul in Erev Rosh Hashanah this year, on Sunday night, actually came to me and he said, does he have to write a prosbul? And I, for a second, I said, yeah. And I said, no, what am I talking about? You read it. There's a debate, but we assume the Prisma is written at the end of the Shemitah year. In other words, loans get canceled. That's some say the beginning, but we assume loans get canceled at the end of the Shemitah year. But why do you have to write a Prisma? Right. That's a way to get around the laws of the Torah. That's for another shear. But because it applies even outside the land of Israel. It's harder to think of a mitzvah more connected to the land of Israel than Shemitah. That has no application out. And yet, this second part of Shemitah applies everywhere. It has nothing to do with the land. It's about loans. Good. Where else is Shemitah written? I know it's a harder one because it's only two verses. Well, it's written here, of course, by Hakel, but okay, that's one talk. But so it's in Parshat Mishpatim. You know, the holidays are written. Sukkot is written seven times in the Torah, I believe. There's seven references. Emor is only one of them. And only one of the seven is there a reference to eating in a sukkah. The other six are all about agriculture. It's fascinating. Yom Kippur is all Achrimot, all over, you know, Pesach is all over the place. I mean, got a few parshiot. Rosh Hashanah is the least written holiday in the Bible, only twice. Rosh Hashanah only appears twice in Emor and in Pinchas, right? Re'eh, that has the Shalosh Regalim, has only the Shalosh Regalim, not Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. But the Shalosh Regalim are also mentioned in the end of Mishpatim and in Kitisa, sort of the two covenants, right? So now, and the end of Mishpatim, and it's part of a whole series of social laws. Mishpatim, we know, that's the laws between man and man. So the Torah tells us, the Torah begins the Parsha, right? The opening Parsha, you know how the Parsha breaks works. Lo tata mishpat avyon chavarivo. Do not pervert the judgment of a poor person. I mean, even of a rich, mitvar sheker tirchak, don't lie, don't take, v'shocha lo tikach, don't take bribery. You see already the context of the Torah, our monetary dealings. Ki has shochet yaver pichim v'salei divrei tzadikim. It blinds even the righteous. We have that pasuk again. in Shoftim. The ger lo tochatz. Don't hurt the convert. Don't oppress him. But tam yadatem. You know what it's like. He get remit the Eretz Yisrael. The next verse, like out of left field. The sheshanim tizra'at tzecha. You should plant your fields for 6 years. Vasapta tuata, gather the grain. Vashviit. In the seventh year, tishmetana unetashta. This is chapter 23, verse 11 in Shmot. Bachlu avyonei amecha. Ah. What in the world is Shemitah doing here? Like, out of the fear, we're talking about bribery, don't lie, be honest, don't hurt the convert, the stranger. Ah, you can work your field for 6 years. I'll tell you why, because why do we have Shemitah? It's the seventh year that counts. Like, the whole week, count up the Shabbos. Bachlu avyonei amecha. In order that the poor should eat by Yitram, tochal chayin hasadeh. Oh, and even your animals can go, get the field. Because what is supposed to happen in Shemitah? Food are supposed to be less expensive. And today with oats are baking, they tend to be more expensive, right? Food, it's a mitzvah of the poor. So Shemitah, the first time Shemitah is presented in the Torah, it's a social mitzvah. The canceling of loans is a particular aspect of it, but this is a much more social mitzvah. Your field is hefker, it's ownerless, and you're just, you know, Boaz and Root. Come into my field, like, take whatever you want. I mean, that's Lekhet Shechad Pei as always, but in Shemitah, the whole field. So that's how Shemitah is first presented in the Torah. It's presented very much as a monetary, as a way to the poor. And then, you know what the next verse is? Anybody want to tell me what the next verse after Shemitah? Very interesting. It's Shabbos. If you don't believe me, but it's very easy to check. Just open up your Chumash, chapter 23, now verse 12 in Parshat Mishpatim in Shmot. Sheshet Yamim, before we had 6 years, was Sheshet Shanim, and now we're Sheshet Yamim. Very beautiful how the Torah paralleling Shabbat and Shemitah. Tasem Asecho, B'yom HaShvi Tishpot. And whereas, why do we rest on Shabbat? Now everybody knows. Why do we rest on Shabbat?
Because Hashem
rests. Yeah, but that's not what the Torah tells us.
So that everybody else can rest.
The man yanuch shorcha v'chamorcha. So your ox and donkey can rest. Ve'inifash ben amatcha v'hager. And your slave and the convert. Interesting how they put the animals too. In other words, Shabbat, in this context, the whole purpose of the Yisrael is social justice.
Shabbat is
the poor can come in, and Shabbos is so your slave, right? You're not allowed to work your slave on Shabbos, and your servant, whatever. The stranger, he can't keep my factory open with non-Jews working the factory. And even my animals, have pity on the animals. So that's fascinating, right? We always think of Shabbos as creation and slavery, right? We were slaves in Egypt, which is connected to this, of course. But here, Torah has a very different reason. So that's what Shemitah, of course, is all about. Now, of course, this is what the holiday of Sukkot is about. Sukkot is a time of masrot. It's a time of tithing. It's a time of sharing, right? All the yamim tovim, to share with the poor, the widow. But in other words, the Torah is clearly linking this aspect of Shemitah to the holidays. Holidays is the Rambam writes, if you sit and you eat a meal and you don't give to the poor, that's just being a glutton. The whole purpose of sitting is to help the poor. Okay, but now let's go to Bahar. So Bahar is the main, right? That's what everybody says. That's where the Torah is the biggest description of Shemitah. Daber bnei Yisrael ki tavo al aretz v'shafta aretz. The land should rest. Why? Why is the land resting in Parshat Bahar? So first of all, it's the land resting. In Parshat Mishpatim, it's you not working. There's a difference. You understand? In other words, in Parshat Mishpatim, I'm not allowed to work, right? Shemitah, you have to let the field go. I think there's a slight difference here. Here the land has to rest, not so much I rest. Of course, the result is the same, but what are you focusing on? Why does the land have to rest? Now the classic reason. Shabbat Lashem. It's a Sabbath to God. Why? You have to know, that God owns the field. That's that God is the creator. So this is a much more what we would call, quote unquote, a religious reason, not a social reason. I mean, of course, the social is religious, but you understand what I'm saying. Here, the observance of Shabbat is very much to recognition of God as the master of the world. Baita Shabbat Ha'aris Lachem Lochla, right? Now, and what is the the Torah tell us in the curses? The Torah tells us that, and our rabbis say, when you get exiled from the land will rest. And the rabbis say that because the Jews didn't observe like Shemitah for 7 years, 490 years or so, right? They had 70 Shemitahs. They didn't observe Shemitah. That's why we were exiled, so the land could rest. It's a powerful chazal. What do they mean exactly by that? It's literal, but the idea that God is the master of the land. That why do we sit in a sukkah on Sukkot? Of course, everybody knows we should sit on a sukkah in Pesach, right? Get two holidays out in one shot, right? They make it a lot easier. I don't know. Can you imagine having the Seder in the sukkah? That's the famous question of the tour. Why do we sit in sukkah? Because when we left Egypt, we sailed in sukkahs. No, last time I checked, we left Egypt in Nisan. We didn't leave Egypt in Tishrei. Of course, the simple answer is, because it was the whole journey in the desert. It wasn't just on Pesach. It can be any time. And the Torah gives this famous answer. Well, what idiot builds his cottage in September or October? You build your cottage in May. You go to you don't open up your cottage in October, right? What's the sukkah? It's open. It's hot. You need to, so that nobody builds the sukkah at the end. That's the Torah's answer. Very practical answer. So it demonstrates we're doing it for God. The Rashbam has a much more powerful, beautiful idea, and he says he connects the mitzvah of sukkah to the right. Remember, sukkah is the mitzvah of dwelling in the land. I think Rabbi Shvat spoke about that yesterday, right? Sukkah is all about the land, the arba minim. It's coming to the land. It's move. It's God took from our temporary home in the desert to our permanent home in the land of Israel. And what's Moshe's sphere throughout Sefer Dvarim? The Jewish people, the best expressed, Kochi v'otsem yad yasali et achailas. My strength and my merit. I'm in land because it's all me. I'm powerful. We don't need God. We can do it all ourselves. So Dafka, specifically at the time when we're celebrating our harvest, the Rashbam writes, that's when we have to leave our home. When things are going well, that's when we forget about God. So Sukkot is the best time, especially from a farmer's perspective. If the produce went well, you really find out at Sukkot's time. And Sukkot is when you're celebrating. So Sukkot is when you have to leave our house. So again, it's the same also tied in Tishmita. They're both recognitions that God is the, is our master. The land belongs to God. Not only that, our homes belong to God. That's really, we don't really have, God gives us permission to have our home, but once a year we got to leave our home. That we don't, it's very hard for us because we don't really observe sukkahs like that. Like, we have it, and our sukkahs connected on our porch and then the backyard, and we go into the kitchen and it gets cold, we go in. But as Mordechai Breuer, explains in his phenomenal article on Sukkot, Mordechai Breuer was the great grandson of Shin Shavuot. There were two Mordechai Breuers. I mean, I'm sure there are more than two Mordechai Breuers, but they're two well-known big scholar Mordechai Breuers, both of whom were passed away, I don't know, within the last 20 years, I don't know exactly, even less. One Mordechai, they're both great grandchildren of Shin Shim Rafael Hirsch. Rabbi Hirsch's, son-in-law was Isaac Breuer. So this is the grandson, so the grandsons. So they're first cousins. So one of them is a big scholar in history, wrote a book on German Orthodoxy, modernity in tradition. I think he taught at Bar-Ilan. And the other Mordechai Breuer was one of the founders, I think, of Herzog College, if I'm not mistaken, a big expert in Tanakh. I heard him speak once, a very fascinating person, very creative thinker, really, really very. So he has this, he's also accepts many of the premises of biblical criticism, of course, from an Orthodox view. In other words, the Bible critics are right, but the Torah, God spoke in many contradictory languages on purpose. Now we don't have time to develop that whole theory, but he's well known for that. The Shitat HaBichinot, it's called, very controversial, as you can imagine. Anyway, so he has a two-volume fantastic paper, Perkei Mo'adot, articles on the holidays. So he has an article on Sukkot, explaining what the sukkah is. So I'll regalach it in 20 seconds. So basically he explains what the sukkah was is when they were farmers living in Israel, you didn't go home. The sukkah, you were picking strawberries, or I don't know what they were picking, and they were 5 miles from their house. They didn't go home, and they were working really, really hard. You know what it's like in farming season. I don't know, but that's, at the end of season, harvest season, they would sleep In the sukkah was a hut a farmer would build, not for religious reasons, because that's a rich sleep. He didn't have time to go home every night. He didn't have the tractor, he had to walk. And so he would sleep out in the fields for a week. And the Torah came along and said, turn that sukkah into a religious experience. It's not some sukkah where you can gather your harvest. Remember, your harvest comes from God. So turn that sukkah into like a special sukkah. But the purpose of the sukkah, and as he quotes in this article from the Rashbam, is to recognize you're out in the field harvesting and you're a fantastic year. That's when you're not allowed to go into your house. You must stay out in the field. You must have no roof over your head, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really that's exactly what Shemitah is. It's just, Shemitah is on the land for a whole year and Sukkot is on their house 1 week a year. The same idea. Now, the third time, I don't know, you don't have to, if you don't like this, let me know, but, these are some ideas I came up with. And then the last time Shemitah is, of course, in Re'eh, I think Eve mentioned that, the cancellation of the loans. Now it's fascinating. This is chapter 15. In Sefer Dvarim, chapter 15. So how does it begin? Miket sheva shanim taseh shmita. At the end of 7 years, do shmita. The word b'zeh dvar hashmita. You know what shmita is about? The land? No, it's not about the land. Nothing to do with the land. Kol b'maseh yedo asher yaseh b'reyu. Lo yikosh et reyu v'et achiv. You know, the loan, don't ask anybody back for his loan. Unless he's not Jewish. Okay. Efes ki lo yebecha avyon. You shouldn't have any poor people. This is the reward, that land is given. Rakim Shamoa Tishma B'chol Hashem. Listen to God. It's very hard. You know how hard it is to give a loan to somebody and not ask it back? And that's why the Torah has to warn us. Lest your heart, Al Tia Levavcha Im Bilyal. Don't have this evil heart. Say, Karbash Net Hashmita. The Shemitah year is coming. I'm not going to lend money, right? That's what normal people do. And guess what? That's what people did. How do I know that's what people did? That's why Hillel made a prosbul. I always say it's such a beautiful idea. The Torah says it's prohibited not to lend somebody money because you're afraid they're not going to pay it back. He's supposed to pay it back. It's not, you're not allowed to take a loan. Oh, I'll wait till after Shemitah. And by the way, if Shemitah cancels a loan and he wants it, he's allowed to pay it back. I just can't ask him for the money. A lot of people don't realize that. In other words, I lend money to somebody. He can't afford to, he's supposed to pay me back. His loan comes in. He can't pay me back. He legitimately can. So it's now after Shemitah. So I'm not allowed to ask him for the money. That's what the Torah says. But he's allowed to give it to me. And people don't understand it. At a low tigosh, I'm not allowed to press him for the money. That's prohibited. But he can give it back to me. He's not allowed to take advantage, but you're not allowed not to give a loan to somebody because he may not pay it back. But what happened? That's what people did. And Hillel said, okay, people are people. They didn't follow the laws of the Torah. Nonetheless, Hillel made a prosbul. They weren't lending money. So Hillel had to come up with a trick so you can lend money and get your money back. But it's really sad. Hillel's prosbul is a reaction to people not following the mitzvah of the Torah. But you'll notice, and maybe you didn't notice, that mitzvah, not that, order that you must lend money, even if Shemitah is coming, is actually written in the next, the parsha. First, the Torah tells us loans get canceled. And then the Torah tells us when you have a poor person, don't harden your heart, don't close your hand. The classic mitzvah of tzedakah is right here. This is the mitzvah of tzedakah. And the mitzvah of tzedakah is given in the context of Shemitah. And which already, and in loans, it was, how do you think our rabbis know the highest form of tzedakah is to give a loan, not a handout? Because the Torah writes the mitzvah of tzedakah in the context of don't give tzedakah because Shemitah is coming up. Well, if it's a gift, who cares? But it's not a gift. It's a loan. So that's how the Torah presents, you know, Shemitah and Re'eh. And it's presented as part of the mitzvah of tzedakah. And guess what comes in that's chapter 15 in Dvarim. What's chapter 16 in Dvarim? The Shalosh Regalim. We read it every year. We read it on the Shalosh Regalim if you live outside of Israel. As Rabbi Liebtag loves to point out, or I love it that he pointed it out, only we read it always on the second day of Yontif. It's the mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel. It's the mitzvah of coming to Jerusalem three times a year. So in Israel, they never read that except on Parshas Re'eh. We read it on the eighth day of Pesach. We read it on the second day of Shavuot. I'm reading on Shmini Atzeret. Okay, we flip it. Shmini Atzeret and Simchas Torah. But in Israel, they don't have Shmini Atzeret. It's with Simchas Torah. So we read about it going to Israel. But that's how the Torah, so the Torah right there puts Shemitah in Parshat Re'eh. The Torah puts Shemitah about the idea of helping people, giving staka next to the Shalosh Regalim. What is the purpose of the Shalosh Regalim? Again, is to help, so the theme of Shemitah and the Torah like juxtaposes them in Re'eh. In the whole Parsha is juxtaposed. And then it's so that's what the Torah picks up on in Vayelech. So basically I think it's a simple idea. You don't know whatever that the idea of both Shemitah and the ideas of the holidays are to help other people, and the recognition that God is our master, the Shalosh Regalim. God runs our nation. He made he took us out of Egypt, gave us the Torah, led us in the desert. And what does God want us to do? He wants us to help the poor and the widow and the orphan. And that's what all the Shalosh Regalim are about. And that's what Shemitah is about. And that's what Hakel is about. We come together as a people. And of course, it's a holiday of Sukkot. That is a holiday that most celebrates the coming together of the people. We know that Arba Minim represent different types of Jews. Sukkot is very much viewed. We don't have time now to get into all the proofs. In rabbinic literature, it's a holiday of unity of the Jew. Ufros Aleinu Sukkot Shlomecha, the Sukkot peace. Kol Ezrach B'Sukkot. So the Gemara says all Israel will sit in one Sukkah. Sukkot is coming together, right? We're fragile without. It's the togetherness that gives us strength, because a sukkah is the weakness of man, right? The sukkah represents man as weak. We shouldn't say kochi v'otzim yadi, but when we come together on Sukkot, that's how we get strength. So I think it's a very beautiful idea how the Torah ends. These are the last two mitzvot of the Torah, coming together as a nation on Sukkot to celebrate national events, and then being inspired that everybody should write their own Sefer Torah. If you're right there on Sefer Torah. And I'll just end with one comment of the Aruch HaShulchan. I mentioned at the beginning this year, I don't have time for it now, but I'm happy to stay on afterwards if anyone would want. The beautiful commentary of the Nesiv, what Shira Zot means, why the Torah is a poem. His brother-in-law, the Nesiv's brother-in-law, anybody know who the Nesiv? I mean, maybe he had more than one brother-in-law, but the famous brother-in-law of the Nesiv was?
Baruch Halevi Epstein.
That was his nephew.
Oh, sorry.
Actually, it was also his brother-in-law. It was both. How did he pull up that trick? So the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel
Ben Chaim Epstein. His sister's
he married his niece. Honey. So the Aruch HaShulchan was married to the sister of the Netziv. Naftali Sviyuta Berlin, born in 1816. The Aruch HaShulchan is born in 1829. Actually, he's so it's whatever, 13 years younger, born in 1829, and he marries the sister of the Netziv. So the Netziv and the Aruch HaShulchan are brother-in-laws. The Netziv is a great Rosh Hashiva in the Lajan. Yechiel Michal Epstein writes the most important halachic work since the Shulchan Aruch, and today it's a little less popular. People like Rabbi Henke and many of the great Gedolim thought that it was the book that we should paskin from, not the Mishnah Berurah, which has become the book we paskin from. But the Mishnah Berurah was generally assumed to be for yeshiva people. It's too strict. It combines the Aruch. This is the way. I don't have to worry about every little thing. But the Aruch HaShulchan was probably the most important work of halacha written since the Shulchan Aruch. That was written by the brother-in-law of the Netziv, Rabbi in the Vardik. When the Netziv's wife passed away, so he married the Aruch HaShulchan's daughter. So I guess the Netziv, the Torah Tmima, the son of the Aruch HaShulchan, the Torah Tmima, Baruch HaLevi Epstein. I hope you're following all this family stuff. Not who cares, but I find it interesting. All these families, the stuff. So he married, and he was 36 years older than her. I knew that part, but what I only found out last night when I was preparing this, she was married and she divorced her husband after like 2-3 months of marriage because he wouldn't sit and learn Torah. She married apparently somebody very wealthy. That was a common practice that great Talmidei Chachamim often married wealthy people would want. You know, it was a good shidduch, as we would say. The wealthy people would support them. I don't have to explain. So she married somebody from a very wealthy family. And the idea was he was going to learn. And he wasn't interested in learning. I guess he wanted to make money. I don't know. And she said, forget it. I'm not staying married to you. And they got a divorce after very, 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 very short marriage. And then a few years later, a couple years later, her aunt died. The wife of the Netziv died. And she said, I want to marry my uncle. I said, are you crazy? He's 36 years older than you. That's insane. So I don't care. I want to marry a Talmid Chacham. That's why I divorced my husband because he didn't learn. I want to marry him. So they got married. He was 72. She was 36. Apparently they had a son. Everybody knows who that son is. Who is that son?
Mayor Bar Ilan.
Rav Meir Bar Ilan. You've all gone, you all know Bar Ilan. You've Mayor Berlin. He Hebrewized his name, was a great Zionist. And the Zeev was a great Zionist. I mean, before the Zionist, you know, the beginnings of the Zionist movement. So that's Rav Meir Berlin. He Hebrewized his name to Rav Meir Bar Ilan. And then he died in the 40s and they started Bar Ilan University and they named, that's where it comes from. See, yeah. And he added, and then it's Zeev's son from his first marriage, what was his son's name? Known as Chaim. You heard of Yeshiva Chaim Berlin? You know that Yeshiva Chaim Berlin on Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn? They're pretty different. Bar Ilan University and Chaim Berlin are not exactly so, you know, but they both are Torah institutions just in different ways. So anyway, so that's a little family history. That's not what I was here to tell you. That's just all the trivia for fun. But, the Aruch HaShulchan, so I said the Netziv on Shira, which maybe I'll explain later, but the Aruch HaShulchan has a beautiful comment also. Why does the Torah refer to itself as Shira? So he's not saying so much as a poem. He's describing Shira as a song. And he says, what do you have in a choir? Says the Torah is like an orchestra. That's what he's an orchestra. And every piece plays its own part. And what makes the sound beautiful is that the flute is playing this and the violinist is this and the tubo. And what makes Torah beautiful is that everybody has a different sound and everybody comes together. That's why the Torah refers to Shira. And that's exactly what Hakel is all about. That's follows on. I don't know if he put that, you know, he followed because Hakel is coming together, Nashim, everybody all together to write your own song. And we write a song the way we write a song is the different piece of the orchestra. You go to a real symphony orchestra, how many pieces are there? 80, 90 pieces, right? They tons of pieces playing a real classical orchestra. So that's what explains the Shira. So I think that's like a beautiful ending to the Torah. Okay, let me give a 90-second review or less, and then take any question. Okay, we discussed the laning of the Torah works out the Vayelech at the end of the year, the last two parsha, but that's just when we change an annual cycle. We discussed that the comparison between Hakel and writing a Sefer Torah, orally learning, followed by writing it down, the experience of Hakel versus the intellectual idea of writing it down. Hakel is a national event led by the king, whereas writing down the Sefer Torah is very individualistic. The context, though, is totally different. The context of Hakel is upbeat, joy, God will not forsake you. The context of writing your Sefer Torah is you're going to not keep the mitzvah. I'm going to get really mad at you. You're going to get angry. This Torah will be the witness that I can get angry at you and I can do hester panim. I can hide my face from you because, you know, you're not worthy. So a totally different context to the mitzvah. We discussed the king. This is the king taking a Sefer Torah that he had to write in Sefer Shoftim. The Torah uses that same language there, Lamda, Ekola Torah, Azot, and he reads it now, not just for him, the king has to be subservient to God because power corrupts, but now the entire nation has to be subservient. And in a sense, that's what writing the Torah is. If you don't follow Hakel, you don't follow it, then you leave me, that's when I'm going to come and destroy. And then we discuss the connection into Shemitah. Shemitah is written really three times before this in the Torah. The first time in Mishpatim is social justice, right? That's in the don't take a bribe, be nice to the stranger. And Shabbos is written right afterwards, both on a social justice point of view, helping the poor. And then it's written about recognition that it's God's land, Shabbat Aretz in Bahar, God controls our land. And then it's written in Re'e, again, more the social aspect, the aspect of tzedakah as part of the mitzvah of tzedakah. And that's what really the holidays are all about. That's what Sukkot is about, that's what Shemitah, so the Torah emphasizes. And there's the practical aspect, perhaps, maybe, that they're more likely to come. So that's it. And the Torah is a beautiful song. And let me just take any questions here. I didn't look at the chat box yet. Are there any questions? I see a little bit. If kids stay home, how could mothers come, right? So we discussed that, right? Shana Tova, somebody sent me private. Moshe, last day of his life, he's going to write a Sefer Torah. Was this the entire Torah? Yes, the mitzvah to write the Sefer Torah. I don't know if it's meant that the Pshat in the Chumash, but the way we write a Sefer Torah, that mitzvah is to write a Sefer Torah or commission a Sefer Torah. I assume mitzvah bo yotor mi bishlucho, if you know how to be like a brit milah. Usually the moel asks the father, do you want to do the bris? And usually the father says, of course not. But it's because we have an idea that it's always better for you to do it than to hire somebody. Most people don't know how to write a Sefer Torah. It says, kivu lachem et hashirazot, right for you. Doesn't sound like you hire a sofer to do it. You hire a sofer because you don't know how to do it. Of course, I said, today you buy books and give the money to the day school instead. But that's a technical question. The details are not included for something odd. That's, you know, details. Okay, we'll have to take this up another time. Details are never included. That's why there's the oral law. We don't know anything about Judaism from the Torah. Almost nothing. There's no mitzvah you can fully understand pretty much just by reading the Chumash. That's not the real Torah, as we said. It's the oral Torah. That's what we explained. The oral Torah had to be written down at a certain point. But yeah, okay. Some of the First Nation chiefs who are picked by council, I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, I guess, yeah, that's picking a democracy, right? So we pick a democracy, a leader, he becomes the king. That's what Rav Kook says, exactly. Now, that has halachic importance, because if he's our king, we have to follow him. In other words, you can't just do whatever you want. Like, the king has... He does have a lot of power. That's why the Torah wants him to keep a Sefer Torah. Morei b'malchut, one who rebels against the king, he defies the king, gets a death penalty. It's a very serious thing. You can argue on the king, but can't defy a king. Okay, so the king did have power. So that's a question. How does that work today? And that's why, I mean, I don't want to get political and stuff, but in Israel, that was what some of the people said. Listen, even on the, then the Jews left Gaza and all that even people were very much opposed. Many of the, to me, great rabbinic leaders said, listen, we have an obligation. We have to follow the rules of the king, even though we think they're totally wrong. We think they're misguided. We can protest, but we can't defy. And because if you believe in a Jewish state, and a Jewish state is a value, and they have their status king, you cannot defy it. The people vote, and that's what the government does. You can hate it and protest, but the defying to resist soldiers, that's a line you cannot cross. That may be Morei B'Malchut. Again, I'm just whatever to make you aware of the issue. Okay, somebody pointing, Rav Shmuel Salant, Chief Rabbi Jerusalem from 1870, renewed the modern ceremony. Oh, thank you. I did not know that. He was the one who renewed the modern ceremony of Hakel. Very interesting. The ceremony was not held during the German occupation. Okay. And now it was taken over by the Israeli government. That's that. Thank you. Is there any evidence of Hakel ever happening? That's a good question. I have no idea. There must be. Yes. Okay. If I'm in Israel, I didn't worship God properly. Idol worship. Did I really observe Shemitah, which could affect their ability to eat? I assume no. What the rabbi says, the Jewish people did not observe, Shemitah. But is it possible they observed, Shemitah and worshiped the idol? Absolutely. If you were at the Parsha Shir on Kitabo 2 weeks ago, by Rabbi Blackman, right, from SAR. He made a fascinating point. Why does the Torah emphasize in Bikurim, Lashem Elokecha? And he said, basically, the Torah, it's a fascinating idea. The Torah was concerned that you had to come to Jerusalem with the first fruits and say this whole story to know it's your God. Oh, right. Why does the farmer say, I came to your God, I'm giving to your God? What do you mean? It's our God. So he says, no, many of these farmers probably worshipped idols. That's what the Torah says. We today, we don't understand that because idol worship doesn't really exist. But at the time, it had to look in Tanakh. Idol worship was very enticing, very powerful, very many, very attractive ideas. So these Jews, they had many, all the peace, all the gods. They had nothing against the God of Israel. Like that's the Torah takes a harsh stance against it because of this problem. I've said many, many times, idolatry is Avodah Zarah. Idolatry is avodah. It's worship. It's good. There's a lot of good in avodah zarah. It just went off the rails. And the Torah makes a big deal about that. Like if you make a little mistake on nuclear energy, you got a big explosion. Avodah is really, really powerful. Avodah Hashem is really powerful. So you better do it 100% correctly. Avodah zarah, the intention is phenomenal in avodah zarah. But because you strayed a little from the path, it destroys the whole thing. That's what Avodah Zarah is. It's very powerful. So people surely were doing Avodah Zarah and doing Avodah Hashem at the same time. Thus, that sounds so foreign, but it really isn't. Look at our lives, what we do, and, you know, and the way we mix certain, you know, things together. It's just people. So that was, he explained. It's a beautiful idea that by the Bikurim, the Torah was afraid. The farmer say, I'm giving it to your God, because maybe his God, he believed in a different God. He also wanted to participate in national holidays to Jewish people. He also brought it to Bikurim. He didn't see it as a contradiction. That's the point. The people in the Torah, and that's why you read Sefer Dvarim over and over again. What I said, what's this last mitzvah? You're going to worship idols and therefore write a Sefer Torah. When we do the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah, the rabbi doesn't get up when they dedicate a Sefer Torah and shul and say, you look, I want everybody here. We're writing a Sefer Torah because God warned us we're going to worship idols and he's going to get angry at us. So therefore we're writing a Sefer. That's not what we say. We say it's a beautiful, he wants people to learn. He cares about the community. But look what it says in the Chumash, and all of Sefer Dvarim is about idolatry. Every other line, Moshe Rabbeinu, don't follow this, don't do this, don't worship God the way they worship God, don't intermarry. Everything is about Avodah Zarah. To us, it's not so relevant anymore. So I hope that answers. So yes, somebody could keep Shemitah, or maybe that they didn't keep, but somebody can do mitzvot and Torah and worship idols at the same time, and they don't see that as a congregation. What about votes from an institution? No, that's how the Prisba works. The way the Prisba works is that we convert the loan from an individual loan to a communal loan, the loan of the court. Just like, let's give a modern example. You always pay taxes. The government's always going to get its taxes. Individual loans, not. When you give the money, when the government is owed the money, they're going to collect, or the bank. The bank is going to make sure to get their mortgage payment, one that come hell or high water. So the principle, what Hillel did is the individual, you, Reuven owes Shimon money. So Shimon goes to the court and says, you know what? You collect on my behalf. The court loans are not canceled to institutions or court. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. You mentioned Erech HaShulchan by Rechim 1829, 1908, right? I got, what's the most important halachas in Shulchan Aruch? Maybe. Okay, Rav Avinuch and Mele Adamim encourage us to learn Chaye Adam. Yeah, Chaye Adam is another great book, and it's more practical to learn because it's much shorter. The Erech HaShulchan is like, it's the history of halacha. In other words, the Erech HaShulchan, like the Beit Yosef, which was the forerunner to the Shulchan Aruch, the Erech HaShulchan traces the development of the halacha. So it's phenomenal for people who want to learn it. It's not just the bottom line. The Rambam says this and Tur says this, and he develops the halacha. So it's a beautiful way, and it's all in one thing. You have to look at the Shulchan Aruch and then in four different commentaries. Like, you know, how do you learn Shulchan Aruch? Look, well, the Taz and the Shach and this and the Baragol. Here it's all one. It's a development. The Chaye Adam is the bottom line halacha. It's a phenomenal book, yes, and it's much, much shorter. So it's more practical to learn, and it's a good idea. And of course, there's the old joke that why did he call the book the Chaye Adam? Because nobody was going to write a Kitzur Chaye Adam, right? You know that joke, right? We have a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Now, the joke, of course, you know it's a joke because the joke's anachronistic, because the Chaye Adam lived before the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was written in the middle of the 19th century in Hungary. I don't want to get into it, but I don't think it's so popular anymore. But the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, even when I was a kid, was the most popular work of halakha. Every school taught Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and it was a huge mistake to teach that book. I mean, it was a great book, and now maybe we'll turn off the tape, but it's okay. Gansfried, who wrote the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. He was a great leader, but he was a Hungarian in the extreme, you know, in the most extreme element of Hungarian, you know, Jew, which is fine. That's his prerogative, Beseder. But the book reflects these values, and it's a turnoff to modern Orthodox Jews. You read some of the stuff he writes about relations, but, you know, if you look at a girl, you're going to burn in Gehenna for the rest of your life. Like, that's not a direct quote, but the language is very, very different. And I think the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch does not speak. It was extremely popular, and it's very good work, and much of it is very good, but it represents a hashkafa. You have to know when you open up a book what you're getting. If that's good for you, great. So that's, and I think today it's not used. Pitcher Shulchan Aruch, I don't know any modern schools that use it. The Chaidam is a little more learned also, but anyways, that's a little bit of history of the book, a little bit. But I didn't know Rav Rabbanovich recommended people learn Chaidam. Yeah, that's great. Rav Rabbanovich, of course, wrote on the Rambam. Okay, what did Beit Shammai, somebody sent me privately, think about the loans above Prisbo? First of all, this is before Beit Shammai. This is Hillel himself made a Prisbo. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are the descendants or the students. So the Prisbo of Hillel was made sort of really at the beginning while Hillel was alive. Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, when Hillel and Shammai are no longer alive. So it's not really what Beit Shammai. What did Shammai approve of the Prisbo? I have no idea. Hillel did it. We have no indication. The Gemara doesn't quote it as a debate. No, Hillel says do this. Shammai just quotes. Hillel tikkun prosbo mifnei tikkun olam. That's in Gittin. In order to fix the world, that's what he did. Today they use Pnina Halacha. That's correct. Rav Malamed, from what I understand, they've sold a million copies. Gittin, where do you live? I see like your picture, like you live in the middle of the desert. You have your sukkah there.
I live in the middle of the desert. Maalei Chever, near Chevron.
But you live near Chevron, where?
Maalei Chever. Maalei Chever. It's a small community, 10 minutes south of Chevron.
Wow. Well, there's another Shubu something near Hebron. Maybe because my nephew, in other words, my niece's husband's like sister lives also 10 minutes from Hebron, but not where you are. I don't remember her name. His name is Nickerson. Whatever. If Tova's online, my sister's online still. I don't know. Maybe it's Alma Shabba. She can tell me, but I guess she's not here. So yeah, the Pnina Halacha, I believe, is so close to a million copies. It's really quite popular. Okay. That's it. Getting late. And thank you. And, I don't know. Do we want to share next week? I have to prepare. Hazinu's hard. Yes.
You got time for a quick question?
Sure. I always have time. Other people don't have time, but,
about Rosh Hashanah.
Okay. Quickly. Okay. I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. Anybody want to quickly hear the okay. Yeah. Ask me your
good
question.
Shabbos. Thank you.
Good Shabbos. Good Shabbos. Thank you very much. Okay.
Yeah. The question is, sure. Can I ask you now?
Yeah.
Pesach is basically a Jewish holiday. It's for the Am Yisrael. Rosh Hashanah is more universal.
Absolutely. It's
where all mankind is supposed to recognize God as the King of the universe. So the question I have is, and it came to me during the Kiddush on Rosh Hashanah, where we read, Matita lano Hashem Elokeinu b'Avad Hashem b'Zikaron hazeh Yom Truah Mikra Kodesh. Here comes the question. Zeyecheh Letzias Mitzrayim. What is everything that thing is there? That's not the reason why we have Yom Truah. It's got nothing to do with Yetzias Mitzrayim. Why is it there?
A very interesting question. I'm assuming it's a more generic code. Every holiday is connected to Mitzrayim. So first of all, time is connected to Mitzrayim because the first mitzvah, a slave has no concept of time. That's the first thing. That's why Shabbos, I alluded to that. Time is irrelevant to a slave, a free person. So the fact that we even have a Rosh Hashanah is in that way connected to Mitzrayim. The first mitzvah given, all the Moadim are tied up in the concept of Yetziyat Mitzrayim. The whole calendar is based on Yetziyat Mitzrayim. That's why the first mitzvah, right before the story of Yetziyat Mitzrayim begins, the Torah begins with the mitzvah of a calendar. So I think it's not that Rosh Hashanah is direct. You are correct. Rosh Hashanah is a universal holiday. It's not so much about our experience in Egypt, but Egypt and leaving is what allows us to have any holidays. The whole concept of Kodesh, Mikrei Kodesh, that we can call out to God, is connected. So we're going to mention it on all holidays. But you're right, you're raising an interesting point.
Here it seems to imply.
Yeah, it's not direct. It's not correct. It's not a direct thing. It's so much so, I was listening with Soloveitchik, Melech HaKol HaRetz Mekadesh, you see, right. So we say the Malchiyot, Rav Soloveitchik quoted his grandfather, let's say in Kiddush, even, or if you don't say Melech HaKol HaRetz, you have to repeat the whole Shmon Esrei. Because the whole notion of Malchiyot is that God is the king of the entire world, not just of the Jewish people. He said that's the difference between the Brach of HaMelech HaKadosh and Melech HaKol HaRetz Mekadesh Yisrael B'Yom HaZikron. We have two brachot of Melech. And there was a debate where to put Malchiyot, right? Should we put Malchiyot in with HaMelech HaKadosh or with Kiddush HaRayom in the middle? We do the second one. But we have two brachot. HaMelech HaKadosh is the special relationship between God and the Jewish people. That's HaKadosh, or even HaMelech HaKadosh is the special relationship, Kiddushah, of the Jewish people. The Sadin Brachot is not so much on Kiddushah, it's Melech HaKol HaAretz, Mekadesh Yisrael. We even say, he's Melech HaKol HaAretz, but Kiddushah is Mekadesh Yisrael, B'yom HaZikron. So if on Rosh Hashanah you don't mention Melech HaKol HaAretz, you don't fulfill your obligation. That's what he says. Okay, everybody. Sunday, double shiur Sunday, Natty Help God at 10 o'clock, on Yona and Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15. Triple header on Monday. Please register. Benaya Mitzner, Shiur Bivri, Tshuva Bein Adam L'Chaviro. Very important topic, one we don't talk about enough. How do you practically do tshuva and mitzvot between man and man? It is going to be in Hebrew. So, although he does speak English, but, it's not his first language. That's a shiur in Hebrew at 11 o'clock, 1 p.m. is Rebecca Winter, Tshuva through the stories in Tanakh. And then at 8:30, Mark Shapiro will be giving a shiur on Shaul Lieberman. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful Shabbos and Gemar Chatima Tova, and everybody be well. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye. Bye.